Hello, my name is Nigel Fellows-Freeman. I am the founder and CEO of Canopy and the host of Building Tomorrow's Insurer. And I could not be more thrilled today to have Simon Torrance with us. Simon has been, if you've consumed any content around the protection gap, embedded insurance, embedded finance on any of the platforms or spoken to any carrier over the past many years now, Simon has been leading the way. And so I'm really, really excited about the conversation. And Simon, thanks so much for your time. I think, yes, this is what I've been looking forward to. So appreciate you carving out some time in your busy schedule to hang out with us.
Pleasure. Nice to see you again, Nigel. Yeah.
Simon, what I'm trying to do with when we kick these shows off is really to understand a bit about the person, if we can. And so I'd love to know a bit more about you, kind of where you came from, how you got to kind of where you are now. Where did kind of embedded finance and super app strategies come from in the kind of infancy? I'd love to get a bit of that founding story.
Yeah, well, so I've been for many years, I've been an independent advisor to companies on new growth strategy and new business models. And about 20 years ago, some time ago now, I studied the business models of some of the digital companies coming out of Silicon Valley and then China. And of course, they've become so powerful now. Those companies are now the biggest in the world. But how traditional companies could understand how they operate and then look at how they could emulate aspects of their business models was my focus. And I started off in other industries than the financial service industry, but I wrote a book on the topic. I helped set up a venture studio to help build new businesses that used these principles, and I did a lot of advisory work with traditional companies. And one of those companies turned out to be a big financial institution about 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got into financial services. And I saw this enormous gap. I became fascinated by financial services. By that, I mean sort of banking and insurance mm-hmm. and other ancillary things. And I became fascinated because banks and insurance companies always come bottom of the table in terms of sectors creating economic profit. That's profit after cost of capital. And software and tech companies come at the top and you've got others in the middle. And I thought, what's going wrong here? Because fundamentally, economic profit is a very good measure of a successful business model. And the more I got into this topic with the clients I was working with, the more I saw there's this big gap between what the world needs from financial services and what those companies within financial services are able to deliver mm-hmm. within their current structures and business models. And that gap is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that counts for banking and counts for lending, and it counts certainly, we'll come on to this, for insurance. And so I got fascinated because I love thinking about new business models and innovation and how corporates who have so much power and resources, how they could think differently about their roles in the world and then help the world to be more successful by providing financial solutions that, you know, everybody needs financial solutions. We all need it to make the world go around, but those industries were not very good at doing that. So that's why I became fascinated in financial services and then latterly, you know, even more fascinated by insurance. And I feel this, particularly insurance, has this great noble purpose to protect us. Mm. And the world's getting more complicated, and I felt, let's focus here, because this isn't going to go away for a long time. And that's how I got into this space. And so what I do now, just to wrap up for a sec, I do advisory work for traditional incumbents, thinking about mm-hmm. how they can create new strategies to help address protection gaps. And I also am a partner of a new venture building studio called ARK. ARK, A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, which is there to try and create new businesses that help to protect us against systemic risk. So that's a little bit about my background.
Absolutely love it. We'll definitely get into ARK a little bit later. Dealing with incumbents for two decades, that must have been extraordinarily interesting. I'm fascinated to understand How have they changed? Like, have you seen, what have you seen change in that kind of in your interactions with them over the last kind of 20 years or so? Have you, is it, has it changed?
No, well, it's in some respects it's a bit of a thankless task, I have to say. Because when you're dealing with businesses that have been around for, in financial services for, hundreds of years in some cases, they're very set in their ways, as you can imagine. And like all businesses, they started out as startups themselves, and then they grew successful, and they created a business model that worked, and then everything about their business has been optimized to refine that business model and defend it. And that makes it good at delivering, something that it's been done in the past, but very difficult to do new types of innovation. And so they, traditional incumbent organizations spend most of their time optimizing their existing business model, defending it, a lot of work, interacting with regulators and so on, and not really as much as they should on thinking about unmet customer needs and how to address those needs in new and different ways. And I will come on to talk about why that's the case in a second and what you can do about it, because there's plenty of things you can do, and there are companies that have reinvented themselves and created exciting futures for themselves. But when you compare the traditional incumbents in most sectors, they operate and think in very different ways to the digital startups. And now, as I mentioned, those what were digital startups 20, 25 years ago are now the big players. And they've got business models that keep growing and growing and growing and becoming stronger and stronger because we are living in a digital world, while the traditional players are struggling to keep up. And so while they are still, they, we'll talk about who they are in probably in more detail, but while they're still really important, they've got lots of assets, they've got lots of cash, trying to help them to do, let's call it disruptive innovation or breakthrough innovation, tends to be quite hard. Now I'll talk about some methods that I think do work.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them.
But I'd say the problem is, the fundamental problem is that when you've got, someone told me this, which is really interesting, that this perception, this insight, which when you've got people who are caretaker managers of big businesses, who are there maybe for 3 or 5 years, they get incentivized for just moving the needle, just tightening the screws and moving the needle a little bit up to create guaranteed returns for shareholders. They're not really incentivized to take risks, and therefore that's what they do. But when you've got founders as CEOs who are entrepreneurial, they have very different mindset. So it's a combination of things. It's what shareholders are expecting. They want their 5% return dividends from a traditional company, and if you do that, you're well rewarded. And then that tends to drive everything else in the organization.
Yeah, it's being in the public markets is tricky, isn't it? As soon as you're in the public market, and obviously there's some insurtechs that have found that trick being in the public market tricky too. And as soon as you have that level of scrutiny, expectation, shareholder expectation, dividend expectation, all of those things in those large organizations, there the incentive structure is not built to take risk and to kind of the cash cow that generates cash in the business is very hard to risk, right? And so there's that core concept of the innovator's dilemma and that kind of thing. Really, it kind of sits very core at all of these large businesses, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you can get it. I mean, you can then work with that and around it. And what I've been recommending for many years now, and it works. There are some great examples of this, is where you create what people call an ambidextrous organization. So organizational structure tends to determine behaviors. So you're set up. Your job is to do this, 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 this. And that structure reinforces the business model of the
The
organization,
hierarchy, yep.
which supports the whole hierarchy as we've discussed. But an ambidextrous organization is one whereby you allow the core business to optimize itself, because that's where you make all the money today, but you create a separate space where you can safely do more creative or breakthrough types of innovation. And creating that separate space is really important because you need different people there, you need different metrics, you need different processes, different skills. But if you can set up that separate space and make sure that you govern it effectively, such that it's not seen as some sort of, I don't know, R&D lab without any sort of real purpose to it. But if you can govern it such that it is really leveraging the assets of the core business, so it gets so what they do in the new space can have an unfair advantage. But also what you're creating in that new space can drive demand for the core business. You can create that right governance, then you can create this new, I call it the a new way to grow. And it's like creating a whole lot of speedboats that are turning around the supertanker. The supertanker is ploughing on. The speedboats, they can go off in lots of different directions very fast, and they're gradually moving the supertanker in a slightly different direction, and collectively that should be more productive. And there are some companies that have done this well. Actually, there's one company in the insurance industry that's done this very well. We'll come and talk about that in a sec. But setting up that structure is actually quite complicated. Let's say it challenges various political structures within organizations, and sometimes the governance around that has not been great. But that fundamentally, that's why to encompass, that's why I say create that structure, set up the governance effectively, and you've got all these wonderful latent assets trapped within the core business that you could release and give them to, entrepreneurs to really take advantage of. And then you can compete more effectively in an increasingly digital world.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I the models, and I'm super interested to hear the person or the business that you think has done a great job. Because I think that where I've seen it fail, or maybe not live up to expectation, has been when there hasn't been enough separation. It's been within the still really within the core business. It's like been a part of the core business, and so it kind of still falls under all of the kind of remit of the core business. And where I've seen kind of it be more effective is when there's a reasonable arm's length and there's it's kind of has a reasonable level of independence that can kind of make decisions on its own, has its own P&L, like it's really an independent entity that leverages the, like you say, the IP and the assets of the core, but it can kind of have decision making. And I think it's you need that arm's length for that to happen. I think that's maybe been the failure of some of the CVCs as well, in terms of those kind of venture units have been a bit too close and been not kind of able to kind of deploy capital independently, but been a little bit more kind of close. And so yeah, that's some of my thoughts. I think lines super closely with yours. But yeah, I'd love to hear who you think has done a great job actually in the insurance space.
Well, it's interesting. I used to run an event on new digital business models. Particularly, it was designed to try and engage and excite traditional incumbents. And I did. We had a It's quite a big event, a big conference, about 500 people in Europe. It was, and I invited one of the best examples is actually a Chinese company called Ping An. It's an insurance company. And so I invited the chief innovation officer from Ping An along to the event, and he explained what they'd done, and everybody's jaws sort of dropped. And these are people from not from the insurance industry; they were from lots of different industries. But unlikely an insurance incumbent had done breakthrough innovation in a very powerful and effective way. And what happened essentially is that the founder of Ping An, Peter Ma, and this is actually an important point because he's still the founder and he's still the CEO, whereas he's not the caretaker manager. But he'd saw that the insurance industry was, it's growing quite nicely because China was growing as an economy, but it's still stuck within certain limitations, glass ceiling, if you like, self-imposed glass ceiling, I'd call it. And he went over to Silicon Valley to study the business models of the platform and tech companies, and then he spent time studying Alibaba, Tencent, and the others. And he said, "Right, this is the future. How do we apply these principles to our type of very traditional business?" And he said, "Number one," he said, "we're no longer an insurance business. Step one,
Interesting.
we are a tech company that happens to own financial service licenses." So we are going to be a tech company that creates platform ecosystem-based business models, and we happen to own financial services licenses. So just by saying that, and how many other insurance company leaders would say that? None.
Zero.
Zero,
Zero.
exactly, because they'd be fired by the board, for scaring the investors. But because he's the founder, and the CEO, he could, he had that power to do that. And then he created a separate unit called Ping An Technology. And in Ping An Technology, they created new businesses that were not insurance businesses, which were adjacent to insurance, things but were related to people's everyday lives. So they created a car online car marketplace, they created a real estate marketplace, they created a telemedicine business, and others. And what they wanted to do is to they thought, people don't really like insurance. It's only a it's a grudge purchase. People like buying cars, they like buying houses, they like and they want to keep healthy. So if we create these satellite businesses and we can control them and own them rather than them being distribution channels, someone else's, then we can be deeper into people's everyday lives. We can generate a lot of data from that, and then we can embed financial services and insurance into those environments. And so by doing that, he created this whole, or they have now created this whole ecosystem of non-insurance and insurance and other financial services businesses, all interconnected. A single sign-on, you have one identity for all, participating in all of this. And the amount of data they generate and insight into people's everyday lives is off the scale. And so they can tailor their financial products much more effectively. And they have these their own distribution channels ready made. So now 40% of their revenue, of their insurance revenue, comes from these satellite through these satellite businesses. And as a result, they're now, I think they are the most valuable insurance company. I mean, it slightly fluctuates, but from going from a sort of relatively small Chinese company, they had at one stage, HSBC was an investor in them, which is Europe's biggest bank. And after they'd executed this strategy, been very successful, they bought their shares back from HSBC, and now they are the biggest shareholder in HSBC.
There you go. Switched on, it's exactly on its head. And
Exactly.
that's a that is such a nice segue. Obviously one of the I think maybe the most one of the most referenced LinkedIn articles I've ever witnessed is kind of one of your first embedded insurance 2.0 article. And in that, you kind of, I guess there's a bunch of really interesting statistics we can kind of go through and pull out. And I think you just kind of called out a little one there on the ecosystem front with Ping An. But I obviously kind of, there's the commentary around kind of what was it, kind of 30% ish in terms of embedded penetration by kind of 2030, 2032, that kind of time. Just kind of interested in kind of what you're seeing within the incumbents that you or and the kind of innovators, and how is that realistic? Are we on the path there? Is it going kind of, yeah, really interesting kind of the last few years, how you think everyone's progressing towards that kind of target?
Yeah, so we're talking about embedded insurance now.
Embedded
So,
insurance, yeah, embedded insurance 2.0. So that kind of, I guess, that step from the incredible execution that Ping An did, and that's a perfect example of this being kind of done on supercharged. Kind of interested in how you think the globally we're kind of getting towards that.
so in terms of embedded insurance, my view is it's going to become a very important part of insurance distribution in the future. And in many ways, it already is. So embedded insurance includes affinity and partnership programs. It can it, you could also say it includes bank assurance because you're embedding insurance in someone else's non-insurance business, and they are either designing products or they're selling products, they're reselling existing products. So in many ways, as an example of the B2B to C business model, it already exists, and it's in Europe in life insurance, it's something like 60% is of
Is
total life
it? I didn't
insurance
know
is
that.
sold through banks. Yeah, so bank
Wow.
assurance is huge in Europe. It's tiny in America and different in different parts of the world. In P&C, Affinity's about 5 or 6%, so traditional affinity partnerships about that. Bancassurance is tiny in P&C, and what I've seen is that there is certainly big demand from non-insurance companies to improve their business models, and they see financial services and insurance as a key component of that. And I'll give you some examples a bit later on. So, if you like, digital embedded insurance, so not just the traditional affinity arrangements where the golf club, resells, liability insurance to its members or something like that, or digital embedded insurance is probably about 1% of the P&C market today, but it's growing pretty fast now. So there's been some startup companies in actually, from Australia, like Cover Genius, who are MGAs. There's been one in Europe called Cover. There's quite a few in America. There are people like you at Canopy enabling embedded insurance as well, that are helping to make it very easy for non-insurance brands to sell or resell insurance. In the past, it was complicated, difficult, and it would take a long time. But technology makes it really easy, even for a tiny bicycle retailer. To be even tiny bicycle retailer to very quickly sell point of sale insurance when someone comes in and buys a, I don't know, an e-bike or something like that. Would you like insurance with that? It's a couple of clicks on an iPad and off you go. And it's very attractive to the retailer. They make maybe add 25% to their profit margins.
Margin.
Yeah, so it's very attractive for them. And of course, car companies have been selling or tried to sell insurance with loans at the point of sale as well. So there's lots of digital technology because you are enabling it. You know this better than I do. It's enabling things that were very difficult in the past, and now it makes it very easy. So looking at current trends, looking at the value that it provides to third-party brands, like the example I gave you, and other examples we'll come on to in a second, means that if you extrapolate forward, we'd expect to see. P&C maybe in the 20 to 30% of total distribution being done in this way. Life, life is slightly different, but if you digitize bancassurance, it would get something, maybe get something close
Similar.
in certain regions. And so on average, I came up with a figure about 16% of total insurance distribution in 10 or 15 years' time being through digital embedded insurance methods. And that create, and that's a very large figure when you add it up. And it means that it becomes a very important or a more important channel for incumbents than it has than Affinity has been in the past. And it means that it's a very exciting space for startups like yourselves and for investors. And investors are ploughing more and more money into this space. So that's a little bit of context for what we'll
Super
discuss.
helpful. Yeah. Can you go into those companies a little bit? I'd love to kind of pick that back a little bit. I'd like understanding some of those folks who are doing a really good job here. So I think it's always good when we're thinking of kind of what this future insurer looks like is looking for inspiration from folks that are doing well. Who do you think are doing a good job and maybe some examples of their execution?
Well, I'd say not many insurance incumbents are doing a good job at the moment, because it's for the reasons we talked about, incumbent businesses trying to do a new type of digital business model. But I'll come back to why and how in a second. But I'll give you a few examples of companies that have made a leap. So Chubb Studio, Chubb, a very big
Good
P&C
job.
player. They have done almost what I described. They created a separate space. They created a separate business unit in their case called Chubb Studio. And they invested a lot in their own technology. They hired different types of people, and they went out and found digital companies to work with that could operate and move very much quicker than traditional brands that they might have worked with in the past. So they've got some really great relationships with people like Nubank, the huge Brazilian neobank,
Brazilian bank, yeah.
which is booming at the moment. and Grab in Asia. So they've been very successful, particularly in Asia and Latin America, because in those markets, the digital companies are moving very fast and they are very super entrepreneurial. So Chubb Studio is a good example of an incumbent that's moved into this space. You've got in Europe, you've got a HDI, which is part of Talanx. It's one of the largest insurers in Europe. Talanx owns Hannover Re and lots of other insurance assets. They've just set up their own dedicated embedded insurance business called HDI Embedded. So again, they're trying to emulate Chubb Studio. It's very early days for them. And then you've had from the past companies like Allianz Partners and AXA Partners, who have again created a separate business unit to service partner organizations. But it tends to have been in quite sort of in sort of limited number of vertical spaces like travel and motor. So I would say, just to give it in summary, and I should say the brokers have been in Affinity for a long time. But again, it's a very small part of their business.
Small percentage.
Yeah, so I would say today the incumbents have not fully woken up to this opportunity. In fact, I ran a peer group of 10 of the biggest incumbent organizations last year, where I brought them together to look at this. I shared lots of new analysis, use cases, case studies, and discussed it with them and helped them to consider how they develop their own strategies. And I get, you know, I get asked the whole every week to come and do a sort of workshop for their executives on why embedded insurance is important, and then occasionally get asked to do strategies. But I would say that the general response is that this feels a little bit too difficult for us. Let's focus on really getting closer to our broker channel. That tends to be
Interesting.
that's the primary. That tends to be if you're in a part of the market which where brokers are very powerful, that tends to be the response. Or yeah, we do some affinity in partnerships, and we might try and do a little bit more with the help of Canopy and others. But again, it's a little bit half-hearted. And I can talk about what I think needs to happen to address this,
Yeah,
but
I'd love to
I would
hear. I'd
say
love to hear.
it's half. Now, interestingly, we can talk about what the brands are looking for, because that's the demand side of things.
That's the demand side of it. You've got the enabling side who are dragging their heels a little bit
Yeah.
and maybe not as keen. But what about the demand side?
Well,
Do
the
you think they're
demand.
going to go straight to the reinsurers? Do you think that's a thing that's going
It
to
could
happen over
be.
time?
It could be, actually. I mean, so let's take some really good demand side examples. So one is Tesla, of course, which is people use a lot. So Tesla, it has decided that it wants to be its own insurance company. So, and that's very different to the other OEMs. But they've woken up now, because Tesla's quite a, people listen to what Tesla does, and now they are, I know they are all looking into maybe we should do the same. You know, create our own captive and design solutions that suit our customers rather than just push them off to someone else's, generic products, which has been the case so far. And let's combine the whole insurance and servicing and warranty experience within our total experience. So Tesla says we want to give people the best experience possible. So when your car breaks down or there's some problem with it, why do we send them somewhere else? And they have a terrible claims experience, which is what typically happens. So let's manage it ourselves. Let's design it ourselves. And then also let's make it cheaper for people. So if they drive better, we'll make it cheaper. And that's what the case in America at the moment. So they're trying to make it cheaper, more, easier to use, the better customer experience, and it's all managed through the Tesla app. And because their Tesla cars are computers on wheels, they've got so much data as well. So, and they're thinking, actually, if you we're going to build, I think, 25 million Teslas over the next 5 years, and it costs on average $2,000 per Tesla to insure. Oh, hold on, that's a $50 billion market for insurance. Why do we give that to someone else?
Give it away.
We could retain that. So that's what. So, so they're moving ahead with this in America. They're going to bring it to Europe. They've had a, you know, they're likely to bring this model to Europe. They, in the meantime, they work with a digital MGA in Europe that is able to service them when the traditional incumbent who they asked originally said,
Can't.
no, we're not going to do it because there's no historical data. So this is a great example. Tesla, fast-growing company, very powerful company, goes to a traditional insurer to start with. The traditional insurer says, oh, I don't want to touch this. And then,
I haven't got 10 years of claims history, so it's very hard for me to write it.
So the traditional insurer doesn't says, oh, I'm not touching that. Come back to us in 10 years' time, by which stage the market's gone. So we so that's a sort that's a sort of classic dilemma there, as you say, the innovator's dilemma. Do you, as an incumbent, you need some vision. You need to think, well, is Tesla likely to be a big and successful company in the future? How could we support it in a way that is that doesn't mean we have to use the same metrics that we currently are tied to? Because the loss ratios are not going to be, what is acceptable in the immediate term, but over 5, 10 years, they probably could be with all that data that Tesla's spitting out. So that's part of coming back to the ambidextrous organisation. That's part of the issue there. I won't say who the insurer was, but the very big incumbent insurer just could not, within its that part of the, within its current structure, service that type of fast-growing customer. And so now, what's happening, of course, that opens up a gap. It creates space for startups to come in and fill the gap where there are poorly met needs or unmet needs, if you like. And so now we're starting to see the digital MGAs, which had to originally just work with small digital companies, now winning traditional business from the incumbents. So airlines moving away from the traditional incumbent, working with a CoverGenius, for example.
Cover genius, yeah, they're doing a great job in the
Doing a
airline
great
space,
job. They
yeah.
just won the Ryanair's business in Europe's biggest airline. And Ryanair said to me, well, the reason for that is that we were working for 5 years with, I won't say it was, a traditional
X.
insurer. And they just, we signed the contract, took us 3 years to negotiate it. It took ages to integrate the products. And then they just ignored us. It was just, they ignored us for the last 3 years. They couldn't, they didn't, it wasn't very profitable for them. They couldn't spend the energy or didn't know how to really work with us to innovate on the products to make it profitable. And that's really part of the issue at the moment. You've got brands like Tesla, you've got Uber, the same situation with Uber, needed cover
Makes
for
sense.
drivers. It wanted to integrate that insurance with its banking services and its payment services and its lending services. And the incumbents couldn't work out how to do it. Are these employees? No, they're not. They're a different class of customer. They're not employees, and they couldn't get their head around it. And so Uber works with startup companies who could. And now, because we're seeing big and important companies like Tesla, like Uber, like Deliveroo and Revolut in the neobanking space, they're working with the increasingly with the digital companies that can serve them. And I'll just leave you. I'll just give you one other example, because it ties into another big theme here. And then I'll pause, and Nigel, you can tell me what you want to cover next. But Amazon, is a really good example here as well. So Amazon,
Starting to move into this space, aren't they?
absolutely, they create the Amazon Insurance Accelerator, which is meant to help them work with insurance companies. But you see, they don't really understand insurance. So what they do, they knock on the door of a broker and say, could you set up some insurance program for us? The broker goes to their traditional insurance partners, and traditional insurance partners say, yeah, we've got these sort of products that might be good for Amazon to resell. And then Amazon finds that actually these products are not particularly attractive. They're just the same products on their shelf that exist, somewhere else. The claims experience isn't great, pricing isn't very good, it doesn't really isn't meant, they're not personalized. And so what Amazon is starting to find is that actually it's much better to work with, again, some of the insurtechs who can design unique solutions for Amazon's customers that take advantage of the enormous amount of customer data that Amazon has. And by taking advantage of that data, they can price it much more effectively, they can create better experiences, and critically, the loss ratios are maybe half what the incumbents are expecting. So the Amazon gets better solutions for its customers, and customers for Amazon are marketplace vendors and end consumers, gets better insurance solution that it would get from the open, from the traditional incumbent market. It has greater attach rates, it makes more money from this, and it satisfies its customers, which is ultimately the purpose of Amazon, to be the most customer-centric company in the world. So it's another good example, and but it's still early stage, because the default for most businesses, we don't understand insurance, let's call someone who does. Oh, the company that sells us insurance, our broker, and they can organize it for us. But I think that's changing. That's changing fast. So the brokers are waking up. They need to sort of, become more digital, more flexible. And the incumbents are waking up. And of course, then the VCs and the entrepreneurs are thinking, well, this is an exciting market.
This exciting market to be in, and this it kind of, that lead, those commentaries and those I think something you said right at the end there was the almost the most important thing, which is kind of keep the customer. And this all kind of comes back to the customer, doesn't it? Like all of these things, that noble cause, the thing you mentioned right at the top of today, that the noble cause is so important, which at its core is helping a customer at a time of need. And I know you all of those experience those examples you just talked through really impact the protection gap. They've really done this is that protection gap that. That has doubled over kind of the last decade, and I'd love you just to, if you can bring that to life. Obviously, that's something that you've written a lot about, and it kind of it underpins all of kind of this. I guess the technology is the enabling layer, right? And the customer is the winner. But the gap that we're trying to fill there is that protection gap. I'd love you just to kind of bring that to life a little bit, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. So insurance in general, there is the existing market, the people who can, afford insurance, understand, why it's important, can find the right type of insurance for them. That market is about $7 trillion across life and non-life. But the penetration of insurance of GDP has been flat for the last 20 years. So it's flat. So and particularly in mature markets, that means the insurance industry has managed to find customers that will pay them $7 trillion, but no more. It goes up with inflation, basically.
Yeah, CPI.
Now, as a lot of it's a very well-known term in insurance, the protection gap. The protection gap is the gap between what is economically sensible in terms of cover, and what cover people have today. And that gap, I did some analysis recently, is about the same size as the existing market. So you've got 7 trillion that people spend, and there's a 7 trillion gap that people ideally should have to make them more resilient to a risky world. So for me, as someone who's come into the insurance industry relatively recently, I say, as I said at the beginning, I've always been working in new growth strategy and business model innovation. I'm saying there's potentially a sort of non-consumption about the same size as consumption. I mean, I don't need any more cars. I'm not going to buy any more cars, but I probably need better insurance. Even me, who's not necessarily right in the center of the protection gap, because I don't understand insurance, it sounds really boring, and I don't know who to go to speak to about it. But $7 trillion of a gap. Now, some of that is potentially uninsurable. It's risks that are too big that the government has to bear the burden for. But a large proportion isn't. And it's made up about half of it is healthcare. So people around the world just not being able to access healthcare. And even where you and I live, which are rich countries, we're going to live till 100 years on average. We can't afford, the state can't afford to give me free healthcare. I don't want to consume free healthcare, but there's nobody really providing solutions for me as I get older that are affordable and reasonable and easy to access. Because it's all the current system is not geared up for that. It's not geared up for people living till 100. So you've got a lot of protection gap related to healthcare. Of course, it's 10 times worse in Africa and Latin America and Asia.
Course.
And then another part of that gap is made up by pensions, just retirement savings. We can't afford to live till 100. And then there's an area I'm particularly interested in at the moment, which is cyber and AI risk, which is about $1 trillion. And then there's other things like natural catastrophes, the thing we saw in Hawaii recently, and so on. So you've got this fundamental, this, in many ways, it's a golden opportunity, this gap. Of course,
They're
it's
waiting.
double the size of the
Yeah.
whole industry.
Unmet demand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not, you're not taking other person's customers. You're getting a customer that doesn't have it today. You're not having to battle for a margin on an old customer. You're looking for a customer that hasn't spent
Yeah,
yet.
exactly that. And this is where, so where embedded insurance comes in, is that embedded insurance does, it can tackle both, or it has impact on both of these markets. So of course, Tesla, car insurance is mandatory. You've got to have car insurance. Tesla sells it. That's taking business away from the traditional insurers. That's what we might call value at stake, for the traditional insurers. You just, the same amount of spend is just being, taken in a different way, and those who traditionally supplied it, lose out,
Margin really.
unless they can be Tesla's partner to do that. But in the protection gap, this is, as you say, this is, virgin territory, and this is about creating affordable, accessible, and available solutions to many more people, around the world, and that's what makes this insurance so exciting, because there is this huge demand which is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the world becomes more complex and riskier, and there's more people on the world in the world. So for me, when I looked at the industry, I saw this, it's sort of, as I said, penetration of GDP being flat, but there is this huge unmet demand. If you could meet it, that penetration would go up, and that would make the insurance industry more valuable.
More valuable over
More
time.
valuable, but again, the traditional industry finds it very difficult to tackle those protection gaps. And it, coming back to our earlier conversation, it needs to create a separate space in which it can develop new business models and solutions that leverage data to tackle that issue. And that's why we set up Arc Venture Studio, which is it's creating ventures solely focused on the protection gap, working with insurers, but not relying on them, and not being constrained by their metrics and processes.